Welcome, friends, to another episode of Eyes Wide Open with me, Lawrence Eastman. I want to share some exciting news with you today. Our new membership site has launched, and we will be sharing top-notch premium content with all of our members. Part one of this podcast and all future podcasts will remain free to all of you beautiful people out there. But part two will only be available to members, so go on over to lawrenceeastman.com and sign up. It's worth every penny. Help me to keep this show on the road. Now let's get going. Ladies and gentlemen, buckle up and get ready for a trip to the edge, because we're welcoming the one and only Raw Egg Nationalist to our show once again. Our guest is a true renegade, unafraid to dive into the deep end of controversy, taking us along for the wild ride. You may have seen him ruffling feathers on the Tucker Carlson show, encouraging egg slonking on InfoWars, or just triggering the shitlibs on the pages of Man's World magazine, of which I was a guest myself in the latest issue, interviewed by the fabulous Noah Bin Laden. Go and check that out today. As a sharp-witted writer for the National Pulse and the Epoch Times, Raw Egg Nationalist's razor-sharp insights slice through the mundane, leaving no stone unturned. Now, folks, we're about to embark on a roller coaster through the twilight zone of topics. We'll be chowing down on lab-grown chicken, a brave new world of food, or just another mad scientist's fever dream. We'll also take a shot with the Ozempic pen, a groundbreaking obesity treatment that's got Big Pharma watering at the mouth. And since our guest is a bona fide truth seeker, we'll tackle the gritty reality of the European migrant crisis and the fertility collapse affecting men, not just in the West, but all over the world. So grab your hats and hold on tight, because we're about to embark on an unforgettable journey with Raw Egg Nationalist, the man who's never met a sacred cow he wouldn't barbecue. Ladies and gentlemen, let's get ready to rumble. Ren, welcome to the show. And you have the unique distinction of being the only guest to appear three times on Eyes Wide Open. Welcome back.
It's wonderful to be back, Lawrence, and it's a real honour. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we get in, I just wanted to chat a little bit about Man's World issue 10. I had the distinction of being in the pages of that prestigious publication. Fantastic time with Noah Bin Laden and chatting about things and the interview the magazine itself is spectacular. 400 pages of absolutely premium content. So how's that been going?
It's a lot of work, but it's a labor of love. I love doing it. I'm doing it all the time. The issues just get better and better. And this issue, I think, actually, it had to be something special because it was the 10th issue. It's the decade. It's the beginning of the Man's World decade, as I say in the introduction. Yeah, I think we really delivered. Your interview with Nora is fantastic, and it's
thanks. Yeah,
it will do a lot to. I hope it will do a lot to introduce people to you and to your work and to your background, and hopefully it will direct some people to this podcast as well, because you are very much deserving of a higher profile.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Thanks, mate. I'll put the link to the magazine in the description. Yeah, and I look forward to the next one. I've read a few stories in there. I haven't got through it all because it's 400 pages. I love the one about Casanova. That's brilliant. All I knew about Casanova was like the meme or the legend. I didn't really know his background, and he has quite an amazing life, didn't he? He was just flirting from one adventure to the other and one woman to the other. And, oh, God, yeah, I felt like I'd lived it myself. But yeah, it was really good. I love that. And then your article as well about the Longhouse. And we heard a lot about the Longhouse, don't we, in the Twitter feed or in Frog Twitter, and from BAP and other people, including yourself. And I didn't really have a grasp on it. Kind of looked a little bit on Wikipedia, what's a Longhouse? And I thought you really nailed it in explaining it. And I know you've got some ambitions to develop a project around the Longhouse.
I've been thinking for a while, and I say this in the article, I've been thinking for a while of writing a book about it, because I think it's an important and very, very interesting topic. It's one of the big ideas, I think, in Bronze Age Mindset, Bronze Age Pervert's book, which has been so incredibly successful as a kind of piece of samizdat guerrilla publishing. the basic idea, I suppose, is that, you know, we live in a world that is in many respects antithetical to men, to masculinity. We're subject to sort of feminizing customs and feminizing speech codes, and we're in female-dominated institutions, or increasingly female-dominated institutions, and there's just no space for men to be men, for men to develop as men specifically, not just as, you know, human beings. So the Longhouse moniker itself comes from the sort of deep history of Europe, from the time before the Indo-European invasions of Europe about 5,000 years ago, when the Neolithic farmers of Europe, this sort of precursor civilization, lived in longhouses. And there's one school of historical analysis that says that the society they lived in was a gynocentric or a matriarchal society, you know, dominated by women, worshipping these sort of mother goddess figures that you see in the famous Venus figurines, like the Venus of Willendorf, you know, these huge sort of massive hipped, huge arsed clay figurines that you see. But there's a lot to unpack in that idea, and there's a lot of quite surprising things to say. For instance, a lot of people don't know that the historical materialist account of history that you find in Marxism is rooted in an idea that before there was class society, man lived in a matriarchal system, and patriarchy arose in tandem with class society. So the first class society was the first patriarchy. And so this idea was most fully developed by Friedrich Engels in his book The Origin of the Family, Private Property and the State, which he wrote after Marx's death. But Marx was also this was an idea I think that Marx had as well himself. He just didn't get to develop it because he died. But the clear implication of this historical materialist scheme, then beginning in matriarchy and then passing through patriarchy, is that when you overthrow class society, what you're going to do, in a sense, is return to matriarchy. And not a lot of people seem to know that about Marxism, that is actually not only the account of man's history, of the development of man's history, but also the prediction for man's future, that he would return to a kind of matriarchy. And in many respects, we're seeing that happen. And you know, Engels talked about the destruction of the nuclear family and all sorts of other things like that. He didn't really sort of go into depth about his predictions, what a future classless matriarchy would look like. But we can speculate, and we can look at the behavior of radical feminists and Marxists and leftists in the 20th and 21st century and get quite a good idea of where we're heading. So I want to talk about that as well. There's kind of like a deep intellectual history as well that has a very, very important bearing on what is happening at the moment as well.
It's such a bizarre alien concept from the way that we've been conditioned to think that you know, man's prehistory was dominated by a matriarchy, and that we're working towards another matriarchy through the vehicle of communism. But I guess when you look at, you know, what the extreme feminists get up to, you know, it kind of makes more sense, doesn't it? Because you can see where they're heading and what their plan is. But yeah, that was a totally new idea to me. I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, and it makes it interesting. Controversial, you're going to face some pushback on that one, but that's yeah, not stopped well, you before, I mean, has it?
No, well, I mean, Bronze Age Pervert has had plenty of pushback about his use of the Longhouse, and there was an article by my friend Lomez in a Catholic journal called First Things, which generated a certain amount of controversy. I mean, he wasn't talking about the stuff that I talk about in my article in Man's World, or that I just laid out then. He was talking more about just the general sort of atmosphere of henpecking that men face today, and sort of feminine speech codes and behavior and that sort of thing and bureaucracy, but there's a much deeper story to be told, and I think it needs to be told, and hopefully we'll be able to do it quite well.
Well, I look forward to that, and I'm sure it'll be awesome, like your previous work. So let's move on to the first section, or the first segment of our conversation today. And in my research for this podcast, I was looking through your back catalogue of your brilliant articles on the National Pulse and Epoch Times, and you're building up quite a body of work for those esteemed publications. It's a really good achievement that you've got going there. And I was trying to pick out ideas that interested me and things that we could talk about. One of them that jumped out, which I think is quite topical at the moment, is the idea of lab-grown meat, or in particular, lab-grown chicken. So it was rather disturbing, the news, but only to be expected in these wild times that which we live in. And the news being that the FDA, that independent agency, has approved lab-grown meat, courtesy of those wonderful people at Good Meat, who have our best interest in our heart, of course, to produce Frankenstein chicken to feed the American public. Now, on its surface, at least the way they're trying to sell it, it sounds relatively positive, as it's sold as real meat, not the nonsense we see from Beyond Meat and Impossible Burger. It's cruelty-free chicken. It has a low carbon footprint to save the planet. I mean, what's not to like? But you've discovered something darker and more sinister. So please regale us with your discoveries regarding lab-grown meat and chicken.
I would love to. Yeah, it's a very, very topical topic, and it's a very interesting topic too. I mean, yes, lab-grown meat is presented as one of these foods of the future. You know, it's one of these foods like plant-based meat and soy and other ersatz products, insect protein, all that kind of stuff that we're all going to be eating very soon instead of traditional animal products, basically. And it will benefit the planet, and it will benefit us. It's healthier, and it will also benefit the animals as well, because we won't have to slaughter any animals. And it will benefit the environment. So it's a win-win situation. That's how they present it, of course. You know, it's like there's no reasonable person could object to this product. You know, you can still eat meat, but with none of the downsides.
Yeah.
But the truth is that actually what they're doing is they're hiding what lab-grown meat really is. And what lab-grown meat really is... Well, functionally, lab-grown meat is tumors. So the majority of lab-grown meat that is made today is made using immortalized cell lines. Now, those are animal cells that are taken, extracted from an animal, and then by, for instance, the application of radiation or the application of an enzyme or some other artificial means, the cells are made to reproduce endlessly. So they don't do that normally. Normal cells don't reproduce endlessly, but immortalized cell lines do, which makes them cancerous, basically. And so what you are doing when you immortalize cell lines is you are inducing cancer in tissue so that it reproduces endlessly under the right conditions. So, you know, you put it in a bioreactor, you give it substrate feed, and you keep doing that, you keep the conditions right, keep feeding it, and it will grow eternally. Now, the people who make these products don't want you to know that. And there was a big Bloomberg piece about this a couple of maybe 6 weeks ago, which really prompted me to start hammering away at the topic, because I think it's something that people need to know. Now, mankind has no history of eating tumors. You know, we've never made tumors a principal or even a peripheral part of our diets. It may very well be the case that in some isolated circumstances we might consume a piece of cancerous tissue, let's say. Maybe, you know, if you slaughtered a gazelle or something and it had a tumor, you might have eaten it on the, you know, 10,000 years ago when we were hunter-gatherers or something. And it may very well be the case that small quantities of cancerous material might get into the food supply, you know, in meat packing and butchering and all that kind of stuff. But there are actually very, very stringent regulations about the detection of cancerous material in meat. So the FDA has very, very stringent requirements about what you have to do with cancerous tissue. You have to perform a very, very extensive assessment, and the cancerous material has to be excised. And if it's too extensive, then the whole carcass is condemned. So, you know, there are rules in place to stop us eating cancerous material. And yet the FDA has just approved for good meat, and it had already approved another company, Upside, to sell tumors to the general public, and there are no safety data at all. The regulatory process actually appears to have been truncated somehow. I'm actually talking to a scientist at the moment at UC Davis, University of California, Davis, who did his PhD on lab-grown meat, and we've been talking about the regulatory process. So the regulatory process for a product like Quorn, you know, the mycoprotein, the fungus, that took 10 years. It took 10 years before that was fully regulated, and investigated, and the FDA was sufficiently satisfied to allow people to consume corn. The processes for lab-grown meat has maybe only taken 2 years. I would like to get to the bottom of that. But the thing is that actually you can't – well, there are two problems, basically. One problem is there's a problem for the lab-grown meat companies themselves, because it's a PR problem, right? They don't want to tell people that the meat is tumorous. Is cancerous, right? It's a tumor. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to eat tumors,
no,
regardless of whether it's safe or not. So,
sorry to interrupt you, but do you remember there was a bit of a social media campaign, but it was like we kept seeing these images of meat that was being sold and it had tumors in it, like green globule tumors, and it was kind of scaring everyone off meat. Yeah. This is what's in your meat.
That was a few years ago, and I think I talk about that very briefly in the Epoch Times piece, where I say that these scare stories about meat being riddled with tumors are just that, scare stories. And I think I linked to a story from The Sun in 2017 about a social media video. But so there's the image problem, right? They're really worried about people knowing that the meat is actually functionally cancer. But then there's an actual issue about whether it is safe to consume this food. And we simply can't say that it is, because as I say, we don't have any long-term safety data. There are no analogues in man's history for consuming cancerous material as regularly as we would eat meat now. And on the face of it, then there's every reason to believe that actually consuming this stuff could potentially wind up giving you cancer. And that's the worst case scenario. And on paper, you just can't dismiss that. And I talk about this in the Epoch Times article. Then we know that, among other things, the human genome contains genes that have been taken up from other organisms. We know that. They've done genetic sequencing. Hundreds of genes have been taken up from bacteria and from other sources as well. We don't know how it happens or how it happened, but it did happen, and we know that. So that's point one. Point two is that we know that whole genes can actually pass from your gut into your blood.
Wow.
That was showed in PLOS One in 2015, I think. So genetic material can pass from your gut directly into your blood. So,
and where does it go from the blood?
Well, who knows? But it could go to your brain. It could probably pass the blood-brain barrier.
Mm-hmm.
Point three, we know that cancers reproduce by producing these things called exosomes, which are little bubbles containing genetic material that they use basically to infect healthy cells and turn them cancerous. So there's absolutely no reason then to believe that eating lab-grown meat couldn't, you know, cause a person to absorb the cancer-causing genes that are in the lab-grown meat and potentially produce cancer. You can't say, there's no way you can dismiss that possibility out of hand without some kind of, you know, long-term investigation. So they're rushing ahead with this actually potentially quite harmful product. And they're hiding that fact, these lab-grown. I mean, when I started talking about this stuff on Twitter, I found myself instantly blocked by Good Meat, Just Egg. I was actually in a war with the CEO of Just Egg, aren't you? well, I am now, but you see, I was in a group chat with him because this chap, Josh Lekach, who runs Wrong Opinion podcast, he was trying to set up a debate between Josh Tetrick, the founder of Good Meat and Just Egg, and myself about the future of food. And we were kind of slowly getting towards a situation where that was going to happen. And then I start talking about immortalized cell lines being cancer. He just disappears from the group. Not a word said. So I mean, it's
over the target.
Yeah, for sure. So it's definitely not something that they want to have any kind of publicity about. They don't want any exposure for this problem at all. But it is a real problem. And you know, within probably by the end of the year, then I think they will be serving it to paying customers in the US. They're already serving it to paying customers in Singapore.
I think, you know, after what we've seen over the last 3 years, is that, you know, we seem to be living in an open air experiment. And in this kind of current profit driven paradigm that we live in, I think this idea of, because in the article you talk about innovations are fantastic, but at the same time, they should be rigorously tested to ensure public safety. Yeah, good argument. But when we look at it through the lens of this corporatocracy that we live under, in which these corporations are only driven by profit, the tests that they're running, I think, are largely a sham. You know, because after the nonsense of the last 3 years, I trust scientists less than I trust politicians, because it's cheaper to buy a scientist than it is to buy a politician. So we can see that the purposes of these studies, which are nearly always paid for by Big Pharma or some other corporation, you know, they've got a vested interest in that, those tests being in their favor, is that it's to get the purpose of the test is to get the product to market as quick as possible so they can get filthy rich before anyone becomes aware if there is a problem. I mean, I think it was the late Ray Pete, God rest his soul, who said that you only know if a drug is safe after 20 years of testing, which implies that the real testing is not in the lab, but it's on the general population. And look at the horrors of drugs like thalidomide and what that did to people. And that's not the only exact, that's not the, you know, the exception to the rule. There's tons of these examples of where Big Pharma and the government have, you know, run these poisons into the population, don't care. And they only care when they get caught. And when they get caught, they get fined. But the fine is just a cost of doing business. So I guess this lab-grown food innovation and the fact that it's being rushed is another example of, let's test it on the masses and see what the effects are. Because if they get cancer, they'll just blame it on something else like they always do, because they don't know what causes cancer. You know, if they feed the drones the goyslop and while they get filthy rich, if it kills the masses before they reach 65, who cares? It's just another useless eater that's not drawing a pension anymore. So I think we need to attack, you know, whatever's driving these corporate profit machines to end this madness. And what's your take on that?
Look, I mean, here's something. When you actually go through this regulatory process, if as I'm talking now as if I'm the corporation, you get to submit your own safety data, right? So good meat wasn't subject to an external investigation. There weren't external scientists coming in to test their products and, you know, objectively, rigorously, without any kind of personal interest, assess whether they're harmful or not. They got to submit their own safety data and their own scientific analysis of their product, of its purity and composition, etc., right? And, I mean, that was also the case, for instance, when Impossible Burger, you may or may not know, there's a special ingredient in Impossible Burger called heme, which is a genetically modified ingredient that makes the burger bleed when you bite into it, right?
Yeah, disgusting.
And, yeah, disgusting. And there were all sorts of safety concerns about it. And I think some independent testing was done, and it looked like it, I think it induced tumors in mice, basically, something like that. It was bad anyway, but it got passed because as part of the regulatory process, Impossible got to submit their own safety data, and that's how it works.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. So yes, I mean, you're totally right about the profit motive. The profit motive comes before all. If you didn't know that already, yeah, it does. It comes before everything else, and it certainly, we don't in any sense exercise abundant caution or even mild caution, you know. And that's something that events of the last 3 years have proven definitively. But you know, events of the past 5-7 decades have proven that too. And I talk in the Epoch Times article about plastics, for instance, you know.
Yeah.
If only we had stopped and investigated the properties of plastics a little deeper, then maybe we wouldn't now be in a situation, and I think we're going to talk about this a little bit later, a situation where actually because of endocrine disrupting chemicals in plastics, by 2045 humans may not be able to reproduce by natural means. And that's because plastics, we've become addicted to plastics. Plastics are ubiquitous. Our world is plastic, and
we live in a box of plastic. The paint is plastic, the floors are plastic, the windows are plastic. You know, we just live in plastic boxes all of our lives.
Yeah, yeah. And now, because of that, we're inhaling plastic everywhere we go. You know, we're absorbing plastic through our skin when we wash in the bath and the shower.
It's like the plot of a sci-fi film, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah, yeah, it is. I mean, it's you know, a slow chemical death of our own creation because we were addicted to a substance or became addicted to a substance that you could form into any shape you could imagine, you know, with great ease, and that allowed the creation of a new epoch of hyper-consumerism. Well, was it worth it? I don't know. I don't think so.
No, we need something quite radical to change, don't we, really, because we're heading in a direction that doesn't look good, and it looks like it's taking us further and further away from our natural design and from nature. But I don't think all is lost. We've got to remain positive, or I guess if you're a Schopenhauer advocate, you wouldn't remain positive. But so in terms of what's happening and the why they're rushing it, I think there's an other motive too. I don't think it's just profit driven, although that's definitely an overriding factor, is that they seem to be working towards a plan, towards a time scale, a timetable. You know, as we see things accelerating at a crazy speed right now, the cultural battle that's going on at the moment is just crazy. You don't know where to keep up. It's coming at us from so many angles. And this idea of moving us towards a plant-based diet is part of the Great Reset, which we've discussed in previous podcasts. But what we're seeing is kind of a rejection of some of these policies, specifically when it comes to the goyslop, or, you know, this gruel that they're trying to sell us. We're seeing people reject on a large scale plant-based meats, plant-based eggs, plant-based milk. You know, just even calling them so absurd, isn't it? Plant-based eggs. I mean, it's probably one of the most absurd titles ever, that one. But no matter how hard they drive this marketing and extreme propaganda, there is something deep within our subconscious that recognizes that what they're trying to serve us up is slave food, dressed up with artificial flavors and other chemicals to try and trick us into accepting it. But it's not working, which is quite good news. And so but the thing is that obviously they're not going to give up, right? They're going to keep going and keep going and keep going. And we've got to keep pushing back and pushing back and pushing back. But they're trying different tactics now. And you talk about it in one of your articles about how that company, Oatly, who project itself as, progressive and trying to save the world, and we want the world to be a better place and ethical and compassionate. Well, when it comes to selling their product, all those values go out the window because they're using tactics such as shame. They're trying to shame us into drinking oat-based milk, and then you have their partners in the government, because let's not kid ourselves, is that the government and these corporations are hand in glove. I don't believe it's the corporations controlling the government. I believe the government and the intelligence agencies and the communist deep state behind them are the ones who are giving the corporations their marching orders, and they're making sure that they're well paid and well funded. And they're like the forward soldiers that are fighting this war. So you have the government providing support, the cavalry or the artillery, if you like, by using inflation as a weapon to price the common man out of the meat market. And they're using nudge tactics and to nudge the meat off the shelves in the supermarket. So the option isn't even there, because it's just out of reach for the common man. It's only the elite that will be eating meat like it was in the feudal times. It was only the rich and the landowners that were allowed to hunt meat. So tell us your thoughts about the shift in the way they're trying to foist this on the public, the propaganda and the tactics, the despicable tactics that they're using.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. There is no doubt that the majority of people do not want to eat these products. And the thing is that this is well established, and the companies and advocates of these, the makers of these products and the advocates of these products know that now. They know that without a shadow of a doubt. They're in no doubt about this either. So you see various different studies, polls that have been commissioned, scientific research papers, all that kind of stuff about the fact that actually, if you want to get people to eat plant-based meat rather than hamburgers, you can't rely on claims about the health benefits or the taste benefits. People do not believe it. Nobody believes that a plant-based burger is healthier or tastier than a prime chuck hamburger that you would get in an upmarket restaurant, or that you would make yourself. They don't believe that shit, and it's bullshit. They know it's bullshit. People aren't that stupid. So what do you have to do? Well, you have to find another way then to convince people not to eat meat. And there are studies that make this quite explicit. You need to rely on social messaging, they say, and they mean things like shame. You have to shame people and make them feel ashamed to choose meat over a plant-based alternative. And that's exactly what Oatly did with its Help Dad campaign, where it ran this disgusting series of adverts featuring these horrible, horrible, woke nightmare teenagers shaming their hopelessly incompetent, unhip fathers because they're going to the fridge to get a glass of cow's milk. It's like something from East Germany in the 1980s or something, just really hideous. And so they're really pivoting. They're really pivoting now, have been pivoting to advance the plant-based agenda, advance this global food transformation by means of things like, shame-based messaging, making people ashamed of wanting to eat traditional animal products, but also weaponizing inflation. That's a big thing. There was a very interesting mask off moment in the New York Times. There was an op-ed that I talk about in my book, The Eggs Benedict Option, and I've talked about it in some of my articles as well. It was an op-ed, I think, in the early summer of last year, So You Want to Eat, So You Want to Buy Meat in This Economy. And it was an op-ed in favor of weaponizing inflation to force Americans to give up meat, basically. Mm. And it was talking about, among other things, that the writer of this article was talking about how during World War One, after the US entered World War One in 1917, this act called the Lever Act was passed. Which allowed the federal government to requisition stores of food from the general public. And the author of this op-ed said, oh, you know, maybe we'll see something like that in the future, like door-to-door meat requisitions from ordinary people. I mean,
look, check your fridge.
But after everything that's happened over the past 3 years, I wouldn't discount the possibility of that happening in the future.
Yeah, they're capable of anything.
Yeah. And then we've got all of these bizarre spate of fires and catastrophes at meat processing plants and on farms and in egg production, in egg processing facilities and all this kind of stuff. I mean, there was a huge fire yesterday or the day before in a dairy farm in the US, massive dairy farm that I think killed something like 14,000 cattle, might have been 40,000 cattle. It was a huge number of cattle just up in flames. And I've been looking into it, and there are no parallels for this happening. You know, like you get occasional small farms, you get occasional small fires at dairies, you know, and maybe like a couple of cattle die or something. But for tens of thousands of cattle to be killed in an enormous conflagration is just totally unprecedented. And
but the fact that the government aren't doing anything about it tells you that the government are in on it.
Well, I mean, Tucker Carlson did a great segment on this a couple of months ago where he said, you know, at the very least, why don't we investigate the possibility that this might actually be a pattern, that this might be deliberate, you know, that this isn't just a series of strange coincidences. But there's absolutely no desire by the government to do so, or legislators, lawmakers. So, they're trying a wide variety of tactics but consent doesn't come into it. It's not about choice. I wrote an article as well about this notion of climate rationing that's gaining ground now as well. So they're talking about carbon taxes, but with a specific focus on 1940s style rationing, like World War II style rationing, you know, where you have a carbon allowance and you're only allowed X amount of meat a month or a week or a year or whatever. To save the planet, of course, and obviously, you know, products like meat and fuel and other things will be essentially priced out of the reach of most normal people, and so they'll have to eat lab-grown meat if they want something that's like meat, or they'll have to eat a Beyond Burger if they want something resembling a burger. Mm. So we need to. I mean, it's going to be difficult to fight this, because what we actually need, because it's not happening in the realm of choice, these changes aren't taking place in the realm of choice, we can't choose our way out of them, you know. We can't just choose not to buy. People don't buy Impossible Burger. People don't buy Beyond Meat. But still, they're foisting this on us. There needs to be some kind of determined political movement. I mean, that's what I'm advocating for in my book, The Eggs Benedict Option, is a determined political movement that asserts our right to continue consuming the nutrient-dense animal foods that we need to be full human beings.
Well, the saying is, isn't it, that if the situation was hopeless, propaganda would be unnecessary. And the fact that they have to use propaganda every minute of every day tells you that the situation isn't hopeless, and that we can find a way to free ourselves from this enslavement. I've been getting into a little thing in America at the moment, which is called private members associations. And there's a movement across America in which people are setting up their own private members clubs, if you like. And what they're finding is that once they do and they operate within that realm, they are not subject to a lot of the public law because it's private and the public law is for the public. There's stories of people who were opening their grocery stores during COVID as long as they were a private members association selling alcohol and everything. And it's developed from there and they've got a private members bank and they're just using it as a way to run an alternative system. Because we're told that, you know, beating this system is almost impossible. So maybe running an alternative one alongside it might be a solution. But okay, that's the end of this segment. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a short while.
See you in a moment. You open the door and you step inside. We're inside our hearts. Now imagine your pain is a white ball of healing light. That's right. Is a white ball of healing light. I don't think so. This is your life, good to the last drop. Doesn't get any better than this. This is your life, and it's ending 1 minute at a time. This isn't a seminar, this isn't a weekend retreat. Where you are now, you can't even imagine what the bottom will be like. Only after disaster can we be resurrected. It's only after you've lost everything that you're free to do anything.
Welcome back. Nothing is static. We've had a nice little cup of coffee. We're chilled, we're warmed up, and we're ready for the second segment. Hope you are too. So, We've talked about the fake meat and the fake food that they're trying to foist on us. And that's also part of this whole obesity epidemic that is crippling the West, crippling the US, crippling the UK. I'm pretty sure anywhere that the American global empire is present, they're also trying to, you know, destroy the health of those people too. And it's a real, real puzzle about what's causing it and why it's happening. But we see this, you know, getting really, really weird, really weird. But what's come to my attention, and then when I saw you writing about it as well, I thought, okay, this is a, you know, this seems to be emerging to the surface in popular discourse. And it's about the Ozempic phenomenon, the fat jab or the fat pen, as it's called. And it seems to be like an antidote, like a big pharma antidote to the obesity epidemic, as like a quick fix cheat to get out of, you know, get out of jail quick. And in the UK and in Liverpool, where I'm from, it's called the fat pen, right? That's what the, you know, the colloquial name for it is. And it's all the rage. No, everyone's using it. And people are buying them on the black market for like 150 quid. Well, if you go and see an endocrinologist, you're going to pay something like a grand. And as I understand it, how it works is that it suppresses your appetite, makes you feel full because you're injecting a gut hormone. And that by doing that, you don't want to eat. And when you don't want to eat, you got to lose weight. Simple, not hard. But there are some quite severe side effects that I don't hear discussed as much as the benefits of the pen. And they're vomiting, extreme nausea, dizziness, and other side effects that, you know, aren't talked about. It seems like this is just a Band-Aid, you know, for people to lose weight without addressing the cause. As the NHS certainly not going to give you an education on nutrition or explain how big pharma simply treats the disease caused by big agriculture. And the conspiratorial amongst us would suggest that these corporate giants might actually even be working together. So I know you've done quite a bit of research into this topic. So give us your take on the Ozempic phenomenon.
Yeah, I think Ozempic really is an encapsulation of absolutely everything that is wrong with the way that we live today. It really is. It's. I mean, look, I want people to lose weight. I want people to be healthier. But injecting Ozempic will not make you healthier. And that's the argument that I make. It not only will it not make you healthier, it won't make society healthier either. And the health of society, that's actually quite a complicated question that goes just beyond the physical and mental health of individuals. But I talk about this in the article that I wrote for the Epoch Times. You know, Ozempic is, I mean, you say it's a band-aid. Yes, it is a band-aid in that regard. And what it does is it, first of all, it absolves people of any kind of personal responsibility for their weight, right? Mm-hmm. And this is, I mean, the medicalization of society is a very, very dangerous thing, as we've the progressing medicalization of society, because, you know, I mean, more and more of our lives now are in the hands of medical professionals. And, you know, for the last 3 years, we've had medical professionals deciding whether or not we could leave our homes and who we could or couldn't have sex with and associate with and all that kind of stuff. I mean, we have given the medical profession and scientists basically untrammeled power, actually, to decide the course of our lives and the extent of our liberty. So we really should be very, very suspicious of surrendering yet more power to the medical establishment. And now what we're doing with, and this is how the drug is being marketed as well. You know, there are adverts in the subway in New York and on billboards and whatever that say, it's not your fault, you're fat. Being fat is a condition like any other disease. You know, so it's like having athlete's foot or, you know, being born with an undescended testicle or anything like that, right? It's just, it's something that the medicine is here to treat, and it's not your fault at all. You know, we don't have to talk about character or life choices or anything like that. It's just like, just get the fat pen and you won't be fat anymore. But what that does, among other things, is, not only are we surrendering our agency, surrendering control of our lives, yet more control of our lives to the medical establishment, we're also not addressing the underlying causes of obesity. Now, obesity is a complicated phenomenon. I would be the first person to say that, and it encompasses a massive variety of factors. You know, exposure to environmental chemicals, estrogenic chemicals, exposure to other forms of toxic chemical, all sorts of factors are involved. Genetics, life choices, poverty. You know, whether you have access to, whether you live in a food desert, where you live, all sorts of stuff like that. But there is the fundamental fact is that we are getting sicker and more overweight because we live lives that are radically different from the lives of our ancestors. Over the last 100 years, last century and a half, we have abandoned, we've broken with the past, with the way that our ancestors lived. We are massively sedentary and we eat basically a totally different diet, and we have all sorts of other bad personal habits as well. That's the fundamental cause of our ill health. And getting people to stab themselves with a fat pen once a day or however often they do it is not in any sense going to address that fundamental fact that we are living in a way that is so at odds with our evolutionary history. That's what's making us ill, is the fact that we are maladapted. Our lifestyles are maladaptive. So that is the argument that I'm making in the article, is that actually it will make Novo Nordisk, the manufacturer of Wegovy and Ozempic, it will make them very rich. It'll benefit them, but it won't actually benefit us in the long term, because all of the underlying causes of our ill health and unhappiness will remain. The other thing, actually, just to go back to, you know, you were talking about side effects, the negative side effects. Rat studies have shown that already that treatment with semaglutide, which is the drug name, causes thyroid tumors. Okay, so we know that it induces thyroid tumors in mice. So, I mean, who knows? We don't have any long-term safety data for its use in humans. Humans are literally, again, being used as lab mice. And we may very well see people developing thyroid tumors as a result or some other horrible side effect. But again, the fact that it does cause thyroid tumors in mice should be reason for us to exercise abundant caution. But again, because Novo Nordisk, Novo Nordisk is poised to become one of the biggest pharmaceutical manufacturers in the world, and it has extensive ties with governments around the world and politicians, and you know, it's been there was an article in the Guardian, for instance, there was an expose in the Independent about the lobbying that Novo Nordisk has been doing over the past few years to get NHS doctors to prescribe it and to get it licensed in the UK and all that, you know, throwing money at people because they know that they will make hundreds of millions of people are fat in the Western world, you know. I mean, and there's every indication that they will have to keep taking this drug basically forever if they want to keep the weight off. So no, I was just going to say, you've got a captive market of hundreds of millions of people who will be dependent on your product. So it doesn't matter for them to spend tens of millions of dollars now or hundreds of millions of dollars now to ensure that, you know, they get the approvals and that it's marketed and doctors are prescribing it, because they're going to make money hand over fist forever.
It's you know, the doctors who are prescribing Ozempic aren't advising their patients to change the diet. You know, change the diet and you might not need the Ozempic pen. You know, they or remove processed food and give them nutritional advice. That's, doctors certainly aren't doing that. No, they're just interested in issuing more drugs on behalf of Big Pharma because it's in their interest. They're on backhanders. You know, I'm sure they're incentivized in many other ways. So without this education, people don't even know why they're getting fat or what the reasons are. They don't know how to shift it. Shifting it is really difficult. And, you know, it's not easy for everyone to get rid of it once you've got it. And all the while, you're still eating processed food. And the thing with the Ozempic is that what it does is that it gives people the opportunity to shift the weight and then put it all back on again, jump back on the processed food carousel, right? And, you know, gorge again for the next few years or the next year or two and put it all back on, go back to the doctor, get another Ozempic pen, and that cycle, they can just keep doing that cycle. They don't have to stop eating the processed food anymore. They don't have to stop eating the addictive junk food because, you know, they've got a quick fix. They've got a quick fix that doesn't take any work to do. And it seems like the, you know, some people, like you say, will be on it for life. They're stuck on it and that's it. And, you know, that's the only way that they can keep the weight off. But it seems like the perfect drug for Big Pharma in a way to tackle the, you know, the, it's almost like they recognize, that they're responsible for people being fat to some degree, right?
Yes.
And that people are bludgeoned over the head with propaganda, they're weak, they're ill, they're unhealthy, they can only see junk food around them. The amount of work and effort that goes into finding healthy food is a little bit above them. They work 60 hours a week and they just want to put something in the mouth. So in some ways is that the system knows they're responsible for making people like this, and what they do is provide a solution in some ways through the Big Pharma arm of the, you know, the apparatus, the apparatus that runs the country. I think while that's the case, and while, you know, Big Pharma will continue to provide these limited solutions to the problems that they're creating, is that they're not going to stop, you know, their obscene practices.
No, absolutely not. I mean, the fundamental problem is the way that we live. Mm. And until we change the way that we live, and that includes the way that the medical system works, then yeah, nothing is going to change. I mean, you know, we're just going to continue offering ad hoc solutions to fundamental problems, and you know, that isn't that's not a recipe for anything other than more ad hoc solutions. But ad hoc solutions make a lot of money, so
as I say,
I think that Ozempic really is emblematic of everything.
It really everything is. It's like the perfect meme, isn't it, for a big pharma?
So,
talking about pharmaceuticals and the pharmaceutical industry, I mean, pharmaceuticals themselves are a modern invention. We survived hundreds of thousands of years without pharmaceuticals. And I guess they've only been introduced to provide some treatment to counter the processed food poison that's killing us.
Yeah.
But, you know, pharmaceuticals themselves are as dangerous as the junk food we're putting in our mouths. They're not without risk. They, in America at least, you must have seen that pages and pages of side effects that go with, you know, these drugs. We don't get that in the UK, do we? We don't get that level of detail in the side effects, but I've noticed in America they do. And, you know, in my view, it's not only do we have to destroy big agriculture who are initially poisoning us with their junk, but we also have to reject pharmaceuticals across the board. I don't believe we need 90% of them, 95% of them, you know, because I know you're a big advocate of a natural human diet. What are your thoughts on the pharma industry and pharmaceuticals as a product anyway? What do you think we should do about that?
I'm in more or less total agreement with you. So one of my great heroes is Weston Price, who was I think we talked about him before when we talked about about the Eggs Benedict option in detail. He was a pioneering dentist, and he traveled around the world basically looking at traditional cultures, trying to find examples of tribal peoples who displayed perfect health and to find out what it was they were eating. And it became very clear from his work that actually the best preventative medicine is a good diet, is a proper diet. So he found tribal societies that suffered none of the prevailing diseases of the modern age. You know, they didn't have heart attacks, they didn't have cancer, they didn't have anything like that. And the reason why they didn't was because they lived active lifestyles, and they ate nutrient-dense animal foods, particularly organ meat, fatty cuts of meat, eggs, seafood, blood products, butter, lard, cheese, milk, that sort of stuff. Primarily, they built their diets around these incredibly nutrient-dense foods. I'm in absolutely no doubt that the best, if you want to be healthy, then the model is to eat properly and to exercise, and that won't be insurance against every form of illness or misfortune, but it will be insurance against the vast majority of them, or a majority of them. And yes, I think that as long as we believe that the route to health is primarily more and more supposedly better medical interventions, then actually we're just going to be sick. And the truth is that actually, despite the supposed progress of medicine, especially over the last 100 years, we've only got sicker. Look, you only need to look around, go out and look around at the people who surround you. Everyone is ill. Everyone is ill. Everyone is unhappy. Not everyone, but a lot of people are really fucked. I mean, that's the only way to put it. And this, despite the hundreds and hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars that have been invested into medicine, into new treatments. And I mean, one book that I would recommend that I think is a really eye-opening book, and that I've based a lot of my recent work on, including an article for American Mind, is The Limits of Medicine, or Medical Nemesis, by Ivan Illich, who was a philosopher, very, very interesting chap, wrote in the sort of 70s through to the early early noughties. And it's a book about the phenomenon known as iatrogenesis, which is medically induced harm. So that's the notion that actually, perhaps that's the notion that medicine is actually causing Killing more us. Harm than good.
Yeah.
And it's an exhaustive book about all the different ways that that medicine is harming people. You know, the fact that, for instance, it's been a very bad thing for mothers to give up breastfeeding and use formula at the insistence of medical professionals.
Incredible, that, isn't it? I read that in your article. Yeah. It's just incredible that they're promoting, get off the breast. Yeah. Don't give them cow's milk, give them soy formula. It's almost like they want to prepare the gut of that child for the processed shit that's to come later on in its life.
Yeah, it is exactly that. But that was done by the medical profession in league with corporations that had produced baby formula, a totally novel product. You know, baby formula didn't exist before the middle of the 20th century. Nobody in their right mind in the Middle Ages would have thought to give a substitute for breast milk to a baby or in a tribal society. But, corporations in league with the medical establishment have pressed this unnatural product on us, and it's been to our detriment. And that's just one example of untold examples in this really, really powerful, very, very well argued book about the paradoxical effects of increasing medicalization of our society. You know, we haven't got healthier. And it's so obvious that we haven't got healthier, and it's amazing that more people don't see it and say it. Because I think that, especially after the events of the last 3 years, you know, that should actually be a popular political platform. It's like we have given so much of our power and autonomy and agency to these medical professionals, and look what they've done to us. Look what they've been allowed to do.
It's almost like, you know, the medicalization of society, as you put it, is almost religious in its nature, because we're so conditioned to believe that doctors are all powerful, all holy, what they say is sacrosanct, that it gives them an unduly power in society that they shouldn't have. Right. And it seems that the apparatus of the deep state is channeling its power through the medicalization, like you say, so that if it comes from a doctor, it's gospel and you should just follow it. And a lot of people do. You know, I spoke to a doctor called Dr. David Cartland, who's a whistleblower in the NHS, a GP, and I was chatting to him, really good conversation. I was talking to him about placebo, the power of placebo, how important it is in medicine as well, and how powerful it can be to heal the human body is to start with the mind. And he said, you wouldn't believe how powerful placebo is when it comes to treating patients. And he says, you know, we know that and we use it in practice, is that depending on what words come out my mouth can determine how the patient leaves the room, right? And, you know, whether they believe what they're saying or not has an effect upon the human organism, on the psyche, that can then affect the health of the body. You know, they're really in an unduly powerful position. And I think the best tonic to put the big pharma out of business is they have no product to sell to a healthy person. A healthy person doesn't need big pharma, doesn't need pharmaceuticals, doesn't need drugs, doesn't need doctors. And the road to health, I guess, begins with diet. And if we look back to a natural human diet, like you advocate and Weston Price does and a lot of others, you know, that it seems to be that that's the way we lived for hundreds of thousands of years. And it's only in the last 100 years that we are eating food that is just completely alien to our adaptive way of being. Is that, you know, what do we do with this shit when it comes in us? We just don't know what to do with it. It's toxifying. The body can't get rid of it, so it stores it as fat in the hope that one day the toxins won't be coming in, and then the body can deal with the stored toxins in the fat in our bodies, and we can become healthy again. So, yeah, I think that's the way we beat them, is don't be sick, you know, be healthy. It's easier said than done, of course.
Yes, yeah, it is, because you have arrayed against you the entire forces of the of government, the state, the medical industry, the propaganda arm, the media. I mean, everybody is telling you that actually, you know, you need to trust the science. You need to do what the men in the white coats with the glasses tell you. The thing about the religious thing is interesting because in that book, Medical Nemesis, then Ivan Illich makes the argument that actually the reason why society is one of the fundamental reasons why society is so medicalized is because we've replaced a theological, i.e. Christian, conception of pain and its relationship to man's existence, pain as an essential part of man's existence. You know, it can be a revelation of God's purpose, etc. You know, pain had a meaning in the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
You suffered pain, but it wasn't in vain, you know, like Job suffers, right, in the Bible.
It makes you know you're alive, doesn't it, pain?
yeah. But what we've done is that because of the decline of religion, because of the growth of the secular mindset, we have totally demystified pain, so that pain... In a rational conception of the world, pain has no meaning whatsoever. This is Ivan Illich's argument. So it becomes something irrational that has to be removed from society, like all other irrational elements. So that gives the mandate then for this sort of crusade against pain, basically, which is what the medical industry, which is what medical professionals do, right, is they crusade against pain. We're crusading against cancer. We're crusading against all forms of disease and suffering and pain, because ultimately, well, we don't know why we're doing that, but the reason is because basically at base, then it's something that we can't tolerate in our rational conception of the world. It has no meaning. It has no purpose. And so any kind of intervention to remove it is justified. So, I mean, there is, I think, a profound kind of theological change that sort of has underlies the growth of the medicalization of and the total medicalization of society. And Ivan Illich's argument is that we need, in a way, to reclaim a kind of deeper, richer sense of suffering and pain in order to push back against this sort of medicalized tyranny. But it's very, very difficult. It's difficult on an individual level, and it's difficult on a political, on a wider sort of social level too. I mean, we need some kind of determined political movement that actually, you know, seeks to assert the dignity of human beings and their to live their lives, you know, free of medical intervention if they choose. Mm-hmm. Whereas, of course, now the priority from birth is to make you as intimately familiar with the medical establishment as possible for the duration of your life.
From day one as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. That brings us to the end of this segment. So I think that, you know, what we can take from that is do your best to stay away from hospitals and doctors. The last place you want to go is into that system, because they've only got bad news for you and they don't have your best interest at heart. Ultimately, there's obviously some good people in there, but it's controlled by forces that are not friends of humanity. They seek to exploit humanity, and they want to keep the herd sick, because when the herd is sick, they can sell their product. I just want to ask you about, you know, your current projects. If people want to read Man's World, where can they find it?
So, yes, if you're interested in the magazine, then it has a website. It's mansworldmag.online, and that will give you links to all of the digital versions of the magazine. But there's now a Man's World Digest, which is a paperback curated selection of articles from each issue. There are three issues of that, and they're available. Man's World Digest, issues 1, 2, and 3, they're available on Amazon. The Man's World Annual, which is a hardback version of Man's World. A selection of the best articles from the year is available from antelopehillpublishing.com, who also published my cookbook, my hardback cookbook. And they published The Egg Benedict Option, my latest book. You can get that from their website, or you can get it from Amazon, where it's still selling very, very well and still high up in the charts. And
it was a bestseller, wasn't it, on the Amazon charts for a while?
It was number one in its category for about 6 months, and it beat off George Monbiot.
George Monbiot.
Yeah, he didn't like that.
What an absolute plonker he is, eh? What an absolute plonker.
Yeah, his absolutely astroturfed book, which is basically in favor of the Great Reset, it totally beat that hands down. So,
amazing.
Yeah, and I have a website as well, raweggnationalist.com, and I'm on Twitter at babygravy9. So,
where can people read your articles?
You can read my articles if you go to. My Twitter page, then there's a link. I have a link tree type thing on there that's at the top, and you can click, and that will take you to the Epoch Times and to Valiant News and to the American Mind and the National Pulse. And there are links on my website and on the Man's World magazine website as well. So if you go to any one of those three places, you'll be able to find whatever it is you want to find.
You are an absolute publishing powerhouse, you are, for sure. I interrupted you as you were telling us your Twitter handle. Just tell us again. So
my Twitter handle is the unfortunately named BabyGravy9.
It's funny when you tag you in a Twitter post that it's like Baby Gravy. Yeah. Okay. Well, it's been a real pleasure, mate. I really enjoyed it as always. Hope to chat to you soon. And you got any last words for the audience?
Take heart and have hope. As you said at the beginning, we can't give up hope. The forces arrayed against us are formidable, but we have formidable powers too.
Raw Egg Nationalist, speak to you soon.
Speak to you soon. Thank you.
So I always dig talking to Ren. The dude's got knowledge pouring out of him like a fountain. He's doing some flawless work. He's channeling the spirit of Vince Garonda to master the human form and getting a whole generation to chow down on raw eggs, which is just driving the shitlibs wild. His publishing output? Phenomenal. I've got mad respect for that dude. In part one of the podcast, we chewed the fat on some heavy topics. Lab-grown chicken, plant-based sludge, the obesity crisis, and the Ozempic fat pen. We talked about the shady dealings of big agriculture and big pharma, and how the Great Reset fits into this twisted jigsaw puzzle. We tried to make some sense of it all, you know? In part two, we go even deeper down the rabbit hole. We rap about the migrant crisis surge that's happening right now, the numbers they're hiding from us, and the plan to move the entire third world to the West, under the smokescreen of climate change. The great replacement is upon us, it's happening, and it's happening at breakneck speed. Then we talk about Tony Blair's return and how he's made a 180 degree U-turn for the Labour Party, spinning a counter narrative to the migrant crisis. Then we dive into Spermageddon. By 2050, sperm counts might be so low that humanity won't even be able to reproduce. The film, The City of Men, was like predictive programming. And the collapse of testosterone is driving the collapse of fertility, and obesity is driving the collapse of testosterone. It's a vicious circle. And don't even get me started on Alex Jones and the gay frogs. But hey, we wrap it up on a high note with some brilliant tips from Raw Egg Nationalist on how to boost your testosterone naturally. Positive vibes, man. You can catch part two by becoming a member of my site. Cruise on over to lawrenceeesman.com and sign up for a 7-day free trial. You'll be supporting independent content creators like me and scoring some high-quality premium content in the coming months. Give it a whirl. You won't be disappointed. Next week, we've got this incredible healer, Darko Velsek, who lives in the depths of the Peruvian jungle. The dude's like my guru. He's guiding me through a plasma fast, which at the time of making this video, I'm on day 12 of 20. His insights into health and well-being will blow your mind. Don't miss that one. Oh, and my weekly newsletter for members kicks off this week too. Hop on the bus and join our red-pilled, freedom-loving community. I hope to see you over at the site soon. So until next time, peace out, man.